Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science, interviews, and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, Russian scientists penetrate miles of Antarctic ice in search of life. And radio dishes in Chile come online to capture stars as they're being born. Here's a scientist soundbite.
If we can understand what life might look like in these extreme environments, we can also develop the technologies to detect life. And that's an important step in technologies, developing our understanding of life to a point that we can recognize it when we start to go out into alien worlds beyond Earth.
That's polar scientist Chuck Kennicott of Texas A&M University. More with him later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan.
Worldwide, shark attack fatalities reached a 20-year high during 2011, while attacks in Florida and the United States were the lowest for the last decade. That's according to the University of Florida's annual International Shark Attack File. It's a report issued on February 7th. While there were no fatalities in the U.S., a dozen people were killed internationally by shark attack-related injuries in 2011.
Researchers at Princeton University conducted research among college students that suggests a link between neuropsychiatric disorders among family members and intellectual pursuits. Students with technical majors such as science, math, or engineering were more likely than other students to report a sibling with an autism. Meanwhile, students interested in the humanities were more likely to report a family member with major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, or substance abuse problems. The study was published on January 26, 2012 in the online journal PLOS-ONE.
Nanotechnology has been touted as a great advancement in many areas, including medicine and manufacturing. But a recent experiment shows nanoparticles, 1,000 times smaller than the thickness of a human hair, also kill ocean phytoplankton that regulate the climate and are the base of the ocean's food chain. The experiment was led by Robert Miller of the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management at the University of California, Santa Barbara. It was published on January 20th in the online journal PLOS-ONE.
Jellyfish are becoming more common and might dominate the Earth's oceans in coming decades. That's according to some media reports and scientific publications. Jellyfish blooms are clogging fishermen's nets, stinging swimmers, and even choking intake lines for power plants. Some suggest the reason is the increasing human impact on the planet's oceans, including overfishing and climate change. But a new study in the most recent issue of Bioscience suggests that claims of an increase in jellyfish blooms around the world are not supported with any hard evidence or scientific analysis, but instead might be the result of more scientific attention and media fascination with the topic.
The European Space Agency reported on February 6th that its Mars Express spacecraft has strong evidence for an ocean once covering part of Mars. The spacecraft used radar to detect sediments reminiscent of an ocean floor within the boundaries of previously identified ancient shorelines on Mars. The existence of oceans on ancient Mars has been suspected before, and features reminiscent of shorelines have been tentatively identified in images from various spacecraft. That's Science News of the Week. This week's Song of the Week is by band Melligrand. It's off their upcoming release, Waves for the Ages. This one's called Around Again.
Tell me we visit the eye.
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Russian scientists announced they'd penetrated miles of ice in Antarctica near the South Pole to reach a subglacial lake called Lake Vostok. This under-ice lake hadn't seen daylight in over 15 million years. On the line to talk more about it is oceanographer and polar scientist Chuck Kennicott of Texas A&M University. He's the president of the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research, which coordinates research in Antarctica. Dr. Kennicott, welcome.
Very pleased to be with you today.
Now, by your estimation, what have scientists done in breaking through over 3,700 meters of Antarctic ice at Lake Vostok? And they're doing this to reach a subglacial lake that's been sealed off for over 15 million years.
This is truly a breakthrough event, and our Russian colleagues should be congratulated on really an outstanding feat of accomplishment technologically. This has been a long time in the planning, and there's been great interest for more than a decade that these are very unusual environments that we know little about, primarily because they've never been penetrated. So this first entry in and of itself will only just be the beginning of providing information about what might be living in the lakes, how have these lakes evolved over time, do these lakes impact the overlying ice sheets, or ice streams associated with accumulations of water, and just a whole range of scientific knowledge will ultimately come from the exploration of these environments.
Yeah, it's an amazing technological feat, and it's not quite the deepest that scientists have drilled down into the Earth before. But just to considering where it's being done, it's just it's phenomenal. But the question pops up, you know, why do this? What do scientists hope to find in this subglacial Lake Vostok?
Well, probably what caused most public attention is the question of what might be living in these lakes. We're always interested in what are the ranges or the extremes that life can live in. These lakes are very different than any other setting on our planet. They're cold, they're dark, they're remote, they're at high pressure. They're probably very limited as far as their ability to find nutrients in bodies of water like this. So One of the primary interests is just being trying to understand what are the limits of life. How can life change and evolve in ways to cope with various changes in its environment? And there's really two facets to that. One is trying to understand how will life react on our planet as our planet changes. And then secondarily, it also provides us clues to where life might be outside of Earth. Is there similar environments on the icy moons within our solar system or even beyond?
You know, I wanted to ask you, you spoke of the possibility of life beneath miles of ice. What would that life be like? Are we talking about fish? Are we talking about sea monsters? What's down there?
I think the consensus is because of the setting, at least what we know about these lakes, is that there's probably no more complex life than microbial bacteria in the lakes. And then the question is, are these very specialized bacteria, are they or have they evolved in a way to cope with these unusual circumstances? And the reason we think that is simply because these lakes have been isolated for so long, it's very difficult to understand where they get their energy, you know, where do they get their nutrition, what do they feed on? So it's unlikely that much more than single-celled or microbial life could actually exist in these types of environments.
Why the interest in finding microbes in that ice? Maybe speak more broadly as to why scientists want to know what's living down there.
Well, as I mentioned, there's really two objectives here. The first is simply understanding how organisms cope with their environment. How does physiology and biochemistry evolve over time? And these lakes have gone through a particularly unique, very long history of isolation. So it's possible that these organisms have evolved in ways that we've never seen before. There might also be knowledge that will come from understanding the genetics of these organisms. Are there special mechanisms that they've used to, say, cope with very cold temperatures? Understanding the genomics of those type of organisms then could be translated into very practical application for commercial use and other types of things. So there is the general interest just in expanding our knowledge of understanding how life functions, but also these fundamental questions about, you know, how has life evolved on this planet? How has it adapted to change over the millennia?
The Russian scientists involved claim that life in Lake Vostok, if found, you know, it could hold clues to possible life on other worlds beyond Earth. What's the connection there? Do you know?
The connection is that fundamental to the existence of life, as far as we know it, is the existence of liquid water. And that has always been sort of the touchstone for looking for where life might exist beyond planet Earth. And this is particularly true in our own solar system. And so the discovery of icy moons like Europa, that they're convinced now from studies, does have liquid water beneath a thick ice sheet. The moon of, I believe it's Saturn, Enceladus, there is at least the analogy that these are locations that organisms could possibly have colonized that are beneath large ice sheets in liquid water. And that's the connection that people make with trying to understand where is the most likely place to look for life beyond Earth.
Yeah, so there could be alien-like life beneath this ice.
Well, yes, and the question is, one of the underlying questions as we move out from planet Earth is how do you detect life? How do you prove if life is actually there? If we can understand what life might look like in these extreme environments, we can also develop the technologies to detect life. And that's an important step in technologies, developing our understanding of life to a point that we can recognize it when we start to go out into alien worlds beyond Earth.
But Dr. Kenega, this is my final question. Thank you. What's the most important thing you want people today to know about the search for life in Lake Vostok?
I'd say the very most important thing is that what we learn in Antarctica in many ways, and also what we learn in other parts of our planet, but I think particularly in the polar regions, is very much applicable to trying to understand what's the future of our planet. It may seem sometimes that the polar regions are quite far away and that this is relatively esoteric science, but everything that we do in Antarctica has application. And the most important thing is the lessons we learn in Antarctica, I think, will inform our decisions as we go forward and try to be better stewards of our planet.
You've been listening to oceanographer Chuck Kennicott of Texas A&M. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. A new network of radio telescopes is coming online high in the mountainous Atacama Desert of Chile. When completed in 2013, 66 large dishes will scan the heavens, looking in unprecedented detail at star and planet formation. The radio observatory is called ALMA, short for the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. On the line to talk more about it is Al Wooten, an astronomer at the U.S. National Radio Astronomy Observatory. He's also a project scientist for ALMA. Dr. Wooten, welcome.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Now, what is ALMA, and what are scientists hoping to accomplish with this observatory?
Okay, ALMA, the instrument is the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. Again, a mouthful, so ALMA means soul in Spanish, of course, so we came up with that name, I guess, about 10 years ago, as we selected a site in Chile for the project. It consists of 50 12-meter radio antennas, in combination with a second array the Atacama Compact Array, which consists of four 12-meter antennas and 12 7-meter antennas. And all these are located at a 16,500-foot site in the Chilean Andes near the town of San Pedro de Atacama. The water in the Earth's atmosphere disappears very rapidly as you go up in elevation. So one reason we put it there is because we can get above most of the water in the Earth's atmosphere. And that gives us a clear view out to the universe. And so we've begun observations with the first subpart of the array. So about 1983, the IRAS satellite went up. Since most of the Earth's atmosphere is blocked by the water vapor from a large portion of the spectrum, which is coming impinging on the atmosphere from outer space, we hadn't been able to observe at wavelengths, long infrared wavelengths, wavelengths about 25, 30 microns on out to somewhere near a millimeter prior to putting that satellite up. And the thing that satellite revealed was that most of the light in the universe is actually coming in that spectral range, which was a big surprise. And so that began the push about 1983 to try to put an array at a high mountain site to be able to observe this radiation and figure out exactly where it came from. When you put up a satellite, you can only have a very small collecting area because of the expense of getting that into space. And so the advantage of being on the ground, even though you're hampered by what remains of the Earth's atmosphere, is that you can put a very large collecting area out. So whereas most of the satellites that go up, I think the Herschel satellite that's up now is only about 6 meters in diameter. With ALMA, we have almost 2 acres of collecting area at the high site in the Andes. And so we can get a much better sensitivity because we have more collecting area towards where that light is coming from, and also because we can move these antennas around on the ground to make a sort of a zoom lens effect and be able to get higher resolution. We can also get much higher resolution than you can from a single telescope in space. And so we can determine exactly what the sources of the radiation were. And the exciting thing is that the radiation is apparently coming from very distant galaxies, which apparently went through a much more extreme burst of star formation, long, long ago as the universe was evolving towards its present state, than we see in any galaxies nearby. And so there was a lot of interest in exactly what starts this huge burst of star formation and how long it lasts, what its nature is. In order to do that, you need the sensitivity and angular resolution of a large instrument such as ALMA. So that's one of its primary goals. A secondary goal, of course, is that we want to know where stars and planets come from. They're absolutely the basic, most fundamental objects in the universe. And the whole process of star formation has been poorly known, poorly understood, because as stars form, they're surrounded by clouds of dust, which reprocess the light from the visible light on into the infrared portions of the spectrum, the portions that are being opened up by the IRAS satellite and into which ALMA will be able to provide great sensitivity and resolution. So we can look at the process of star and planet formation much more effectively than we can from instruments that are located on the ground.
You've been listening to astronomer Al Wooten. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mellow Grand, Sleep Good, The Black and White Years, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't end. Is there a fight? What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't.